This is your time. I don't know if who's to blame for this. You can maybe blame James Crockett, but it's always terrifying if he has your mobile number. He can get in touch, and you want to hold on to that. He can get in touch and ask you to do terrible things like stand at the front of the church. But Philip, you participated in an Alpha course, and before we get to your experience of that course, could you tell us what your life was like before you ended up on the Alpha course? And hold that microphone up nice and high so we can hear you.
I was just a normal lad, really. I had a bit of faith. Well, I had faith. I had a belief, but I wanted it in my terms, you know, at arm's length.
Yeah.
But in regards to just a normal lad, really, like the few pints of the boys or the missus, probably went off the rails a little bit, if I'm being honest. Acrobating about, for want of a better word.
Okay.
But yeah, just a bit. Just a normal lad, really. You know, nothing too exciting.
Okay. And you ended up on an Alpha course. Tell us about how that happened and what the course was like. How did you hear of Alpha, or what were your thoughts about going on it, and what was your experience of it?
I first heard about Alpha a few years back. Mark Harvey tried to get me on Alpha. Played football with Mark. But no, I wasn't having it. I was like, no, I'm not ready for that. Stacey Trimble as well. She tried to get me as well. But I kept running.
Yeah.
And anybody that knows me knows it can run pretty quick. But getting slower now. So I decided, you know, and Leon Lee invited me last year.
Okay.
And I decided.
So Mark Harvey, Stacey Trimble, Leon Lee, we're sending people after you all over the place, okay? Right? So people are asking you questions. Initially, people are asking you, and you're saying no, but you ended up on the course. What happened on the course? What was it like those 10 weeks like on Alpha?
Well, I have to be honest, they only came in week five, Michael.
Okay, week five, right.
But yeah, it was welcoming when I came in. It was, you know, you said earlier in the early service, you know, it's relaxed. It's called questions without pressure, you know.
Yeah.
And I didn't go to Alpha to believe in God because I did believe in God.
Yeah.
But as I said, I wanted it on my terms. So there was a talk, and then we were in their groups, and we had discussions that way as well. So, but Ross was my leader, who you were mentioning about earlier. And at the end of it, he was talking to me. You know, just I didn't know Ross from Adam. And he talked to me for a couple of minutes afterwards, just to gauge me, probably, and saying, you know, I believe in God, and you know that sort of thing. I read my word of today.
Yeah,
that's you know. And he said something that was really simple, probably something that I needed to hear from a stranger. And he says, you know, you're practically there.
Yeah.
And the only thing holding you back is you.
Yeah.
And it was so simple, but it was so true.
Yeah.
And in that moment, all the pennies dropped.
Yeah.
And we said the prayer.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry. Please and thank you.
Sorry, please and thank you.
Got it in the right order.
Yeah.
And as simple as that, you know, there was no big bolts of light, and there was no just a believer who needed to take the final step. And that's what happened.
Brilliant. And so you prayed the prayer. And what's life been like since that moment? You know, what difference or change is there in your life as a result?
It's ups and downs, like every day, you know, everyday life. But I'm more switched on now, the spiritual side of things and things in general, you know.
Yeah.
But like everything, it's up and it's down, and it's in between. But my home, which was in the corner at Fairhill Park with Tracy and Kay. That's where I'm happiest. But in regards to my soul, my soul's home to where it belongs.
Yeah, okay. Brilliant. Philip, thank you so much for standing up in front of everyone this morning and sharing your story. We're grateful. We're going to give a round of applause. Brilliant. So Wednesday the 13th of September is when our Alpha course launches. And there are little cards available in the porch, and if you want, and out in the coffee bar, if you want to invite someone along, maybe easier to have a card to say, will you come to this with me? Will you come along to the Alpha course? And they'll say, what's the Alpha course? You say, well, it's an opportunity to explore the big questions of life, and I'd love to do that with you. We're excited about this course. We've seen God use it in a variety of ways in loads of people's lives to introduce them to a relationship with Jesus, and we'd love you to think seriously about coming along and bringing someone who you think would maybe benefit from this course. Wednesday, 13th of September at 7:45 is the launch night in the coffee bar. Keep it in your prayers, keep it in your mind, keep this card in front of you so that you can think about maybe inviting some people along. We'd love you to participate. James is here this morning, and Kathy will be here later on this evening, and Philip's about. Loads of people have participated in Alpha. You want more information, you can talk to them and find out more. Over the last number of weeks, we've been thinking about the vision for society that the Presbyterian Church in Ireland put together. This was a document that talks about our responsibility as the church, not just to remain in the church, but to relate to the world outside of us. And that document or that statement ends, but it doesn't talk about the end times, you know, when the trumpet blows and when Christ returns. There's no aspect of that statement that talks about the new heavens and the new earth. There's no aspect of that statement that says what it will be like when it is on earth as it is in heaven. And so to conclude our study, our series this morning and today, we're going to be thinking about the vision for society that God has, the vision for society that God reveals to us in his word through Revelation 21. So if you want to join with me, we're going to read together the whole chapter of Revelation 21. The words will be on the screen, or you can read along in the pew Bible. We're going to begin in verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." He said to me, "It's done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God. They will be my children. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the vile, the murderers, the sexually immoral, those who practice magic arts, the idolaters and all liars, they will be consigned to the fiery lake of burning sulfur. This is the second death." One of the seven angels who had seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. It shone with the glory of God, and its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates and the 12 angels at the gates. On the gates were written the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. There were three gates on the east, three on the north, three on the south, and three on the west. The wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. The angel who talked with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city, its gates, and its walls. The city was laid out like a square, as long as it was wide. He measured the city with the rod and found it to be 12,000 stadia in length, and as wide and high as it is long. The angel measured the wall using human measurement, and it was 144 cubits thick. The wall was made of jasper, and the city of pure gold, as pure as glass. The foundations of the city walls were decorated with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth ruby, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth turquoise, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. The 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each gate was made of a single pearl. The great street of the city was of gold, as pure, transparent glass. I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. On no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night there. The glory and the honor of the nations will be brought into it. Nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. We end there, giving thanks to God for his word to us and how he speaks to us today. So you're scrolling on the internet and you stumble upon PropertyPal, and there's a house that grabs your attention. And you start to have a look through it, and it really does seem impressive. 7 bedrooms, and there's 4 bathrooms and 3 reception rooms and a sunroom and a garage and sizable gardens, and it's located close to local shops, and it's located close to transport and local schools, and there's eateries nearby, and you think, wow, that is some house. But something starts to puzzle you as you click on the images of the bedrooms and even the kitchen. You think, this place, this is familiar to me. And as you read the description and see the images, it's like the fog begins to clear from your mind, and you remember, oh yes, my parents lived here. This was once my family home. An experience of deja vu overwhelms you. You remember this place. It's where it all began. We should have that kind of experience as we read this passage in Revelation this morning. As we get to the final section of Scripture, God's vision for society, God's vision for your future and mine, should evoke within us memories of a previous day, memories of where it all began for our first parents, take us back to the place where it all started. It's like God gives John a brochure for heaven, a brochure for the new society that he's creating and he will bring about, and says, look at this, John. Look at the home that I have prepared for you. It's like John gets a pre-release viewing of the new Eden. He gets an insight of it, and it evokes a memory. Cultivates within him something that he's heard before. I saw a new heaven and the new earth. That's like something we've read before if we've read our Bible. That sounds like something we have heard in the past, doesn't it? It has a familiar ring to it. Heaven and earth, newness. Revelation 21, what about Genesis 1:1? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This is where it all began. This is how the book starts, and now we're getting a bookend. We're getting an inclusio as a literary term. It's like there's harmony between the beginning and the end. This is not an accident. It's not like, oh, isn't that really, that's a nice coincidence as we read our Bibles. Oh my goodness, the beginning and the end are sort of similar. It's not an accident. It's not a coincidence. It's not to cultivate any kind of sentimentality within us. It's God's way of assuring us that from beginning to end, he has a purpose and a plan that cannot be undone, that cannot be unraveled, that cannot be opposed. And that no matter what our present experience is, the Lamb is on the throne, God is in control, and is working his purposes towards a destination that he has in mind. The harmony that was disturbed by our first parents' rebellion against God is going to be restored. Things will be back in tune with God's will one day. That's our future hope. That's our future home. That's where we will live. That's where we will dwell. God is promising that things will be in tune, there will be harmony again with how he intended it to be. Life will be the way God desires for all of us who trust in him. The vision that John receives comes to a church under fire, you know, comes to a church that's feeling the heat, a church that's on the margins of society, feeling inferior, feeling weak, feeling like a minority, feeling like things are not as they should be, comes to people who are experiencing painful opposition, intense persecution, and wondering, how long can we cling on by our fingernails? And John gets this vision. And I know, like when I saw that I had to preach in Revelation this Sunday, I was thinking, oh, there's got to be an easier book of the Bible to be preaching from. Because it's full of all these images and ideas and thoughts and thinking. We can get ourselves in all sorts of a tangle trying to pick it apart and understand it. But someone has summarized it in a way that my simple mind really appreciates. It said, you know, after God in his word has put together all this history, all this theology, you know, all this law, all this poetry, he gives to his people who are being persecuted a picture book. A picture book to remind them that he is on the throne, that he is in control, and that no one can oppose him. Ultimately, in the end, he wins. He's victorious. And all who trust in him will be victorious. I think it was Ray Ortland who said, how our stories will end is all that matters. And in Jesus, our final chapter will really satisfy. And that's what's going on here as we get to the picture book called Revelation. He reminds them through paintings and images and the hard times that they're facing that even though there's loads of thrones around, even though it seems as though lots of people have a say in our life and a claim in our life and lots of people have an influence on our life, we may feel the victims of injustice in loads of ways. There is a throne high above all those thrones, and the Lamb is on it, and he's never been unseated. All the other kingdoms of this world will fade. There will be no longer any sea. Now, maybe you've just come back from a cruise and you're thinking, oh, really? That was quite nice. Or maybe you had like a sea view in your hotel room this summer and you're thinking, really? That was really nice. I really liked my sea view. And you're telling me that when heaven invades earth, when things are as God intended, there will be no longer any sea. I'm not excited about that. But in the Old Testament, the sea was a place of terror. The sea was somewhere that caused fear. It was unruly. There was an unpredictability about the sea that terrified the people of God. Isaiah 57 and 20 said, but the wicked are like the tossing sea, which cannot rest, whose waves cast up mud and mire. The sea was a place to be afraid of. It caused separation. It was unpredictable, unruly. And so John gets a vision to share with the church that says, one day we will live without this unruliness, without this chaos and unpredictability, without fear, without anxiety, no longer any sea, no danger. John says, that will be gone from your life and mine if we trust in Jesus. That's what awaits us. To a people living in fear, to a people living in chaos, to a people terrified of what the next news bulletin is going to say, we get this vision where sea will be gone, chaos will be gone, fear will be gone. Maybe you're here this morning and you just don't know what the doctor's going to say. You just don't know what your line manager's going to say. You don't know what your kids are going to tell you next. You don't know what is around the corner. And the reality is, none of us do. None of us know what the next phone call is going to reveal. I'm sorry to tell you. None of us know that. We live in days of chaos and terror and fear. And John is given a vision where that will be gone. The unruliness and unpredictability will be gone. If you think about the life and ministry of Jesus, his voice calmed the sea. He has authority, his word has authority over the sea. He brings calm to the chaos by his word. Not only does he speak authority over the creation, he walks on top of it. He walks on water. The things that would be over our head are under his feet. If we tried it ourselves, it would swallow us. We would sink in our own ability. We drown. It's above us, and there is no way out but with the authority and the power and the presence of Jesus Christ, we get to be on top of it when we trust in him. His feet walk on top of the things that swallow us and intimidate us. That's the picture. That's the picture that John is given in this vision. Jesus subdues a rebellious creation. No longer any sea, no longer any chaos. Everything that would cause us to be afraid is gone. We're supposed to look at these pictures, look at this picture book, look at this brochure, and imagine ourselves living in that place. Who lives in a house like this? Do you ever watch, you know, Through the Keyhole? It's Keith Lemon who does it now, but I think it used to be Lloyd Grossman, right? And I remember, you know, now, who lives in a house like this? And there would be images on screen. So I've been around a few of your houses this week while you were out taking photographs of the bedrooms and stuff. We're going to put them up and you have to guess who lives in the house, right? Are you terrified? I'm only joking, I haven't done that. If it was still in youth work, that's what I would have done, right? As a youth worker, that's what we did. You took photographs of kids' bedrooms and put them up in youth fellowship, but I'm not that mean anymore. Can't do that with grown-ups. But we had to try and guess, like, who lives in a house like this? And maybe as you read the descriptions of this home and you think, right, a place without chaos? Do you know what my house is like on a Sunday morning before church, right? And I'm supposed to be up the front here being smiley and saying, good morning and welcome to church. And Rachel's coming in with our three kids and I'm thinking, hope everything's okay there. You know, but I'm at the front and we do, like, pretend everything's okay and we just have in our head chaos. Chaos in the home. And this place says there's a home without chaos. We think, I could never live in a house like that. A home without tears. A home without fear. A home without division. We're supposed to imagine ourselves living in that place, and there's supposed to be a homesickness cultivated within us to say, I want to live in Eden again. I want to be with God again. I want to be with Christ fully, no more sea. No more of this pain and suffering. I want it to be gone. We should have a homesickness, but we look through the keyhole and think, who lives in a house like this? How could we get in? I could never afford a house like that. I couldn't even get the deposit, never mind a mortgage. What about insurance? Sounds like a dream home, but I'll have to do with a brochure. Because it's beyond my reach. I don't have the resources to live in a home like that. And the vision continues because Jesus says to John, it's done. You don't need to worry about paying the price to live in this home. It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this. I will be their God, and they will be my children. This is not for the rich. This is not for the well-connected. This is not for those who have their lives together. This is for the thirsty. This is for the thirsty. Are you thirsty this morning? For a different way of life, for a different experience. We inherit this. It is done. None of us can afford this. None of us can get enough credit with God to live in a place like that. He pays. He comes to those who are thirsty. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They will be filled. See, when Jesus was on earth, the people he had the biggest problem with were the Pharisees, who were filled with their own self-importance and self-righteousness. They thought they didn't need him. They thought they weren't hungry. They thought they weren't thirsty. They thought they could pay themselves. And that's the people that Jesus had the biggest problem with. The ones who thought they were rich spiritually. And Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are those who mourn, remember that it should not be this way and grieve for all that's lost and want it restored. Blessed are you if you mourn, if you're needy. I can work with you. What does Jesus need from you in order to be a Christian? What does God require of you in order for you to follow him? For you, all you need is need. All you need is need if you want to be a Christian. You don't need to be full of anything other than remorse for your sin and a desire for God to make you right. We inherit this. It comes to us through the death of a loved one who loved us so much. This new home is out of reach for all of us. And the vision is given to a church under fire. To God's people feeling the squeeze, feeling the pressure, feeling fearful of the culture, bullied by the authorities of the day, feeling like we're a minority. God's word, God's vision comes to a displaced people, comes to people like you and me, asylum seekers and refugees whose citizenship is in heaven and we do not feel at home here. We have a longing and a homesickness for a world without tears, a world without division, a world without pain. We should expect discomfort in this world. Our spiritual passport says that we've been born again in heaven, born again from above. So our allegiance is ultimately to that kingdom, not the United Kingdom, not to any politician, political party. Our allegiance is to Jesus, not to any flag. And our God loved the world so much that he gave his one and only son so that whoever believes in him may not perish but have eternal life. Whoever. That means if we want to represent him, his kingdom takes priority over every other kingdom. And our love is for whoever God puts in our path. Whoever comes our way, regardless of flag, political persuasion, economic situation, or age, or skin color. I was at a PCI conference this week, Presbyterian Church in Ireland. If you can imagine like ministers and elders together, riotous, right? It was just like chinos everywhere. And it was on the North Coast. And what can I say about that conference? It was called Everyday Discipleship, or Everyday Disciples. And what I can say about it is there were some parts of it were really, really good. Moving on. Some parts were really good. Ray Ortland spoke in the evening, and he was excellent. I really benefited from his preaching. He's a minister in Nashville in the United States. And he spoke about a recent trip to Portland, Oregon. And Portland is kind of a really liberal city, really like free thinking, do as you please, kind of just, you know, hippie, like a new hippie kind of generation. He said he really identified with it because when he was growing up, that's kind of the person that he was, and it reminded him of his youth, and he loved it. And he said there's bumper stickers, you know, like these Americans have on their cars, and there's a bumper sticker that says, "Keep Portland weird," right? And that they've got it sprayed in the wall, and you can see it everywhere. Keep Portland weird. And he said that his desire is, that's keep Christianity weird. You know, that we believe, if you think about it, we believe some really weird stuff. We believe that our Savior was born of a virgin in an outhouse somewhere, in an animal feeding trough. We believe that when he was crucified and died, he was the one granting breath and life to the Roman soldiers who were nailing him to the cross, that he had the authority to stop them doing it, but he chose not to so that the will of his Father would be accomplished. We believe that when Jesus comes again, he will call the bodies of his own from the cemetery by name, and that they will be united with their soul forever in eternity, enjoying his presence with a body that is no longer subject to tiredness or sickness or pain or destruction of any kind, that it will endure forever so that when we've been there 10,000 years, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. That's weird. We believe that the residents of nursing homes who need assistance to be washed and dressed are just as precious as babies who cannot control their bowel movements. And they are just as precious and as valuable as Premier League footballers for whom people will pay millions and millions of pounds. And they're precious in the sight of God, equally valuable to him. Not one or other, but all, male and female, equal in value. young and old, equal in value, skilled and unskilled, equal in value, educated and uneducated. Equal in value. We believe some really weird stuff, and by believing this stuff, we will be weird. We will live like weirdos in the world. This will make you really courageous if you believe these things about the value of every human person. Make you really courageous, because you'll not be overly impressed with the people whom the world deems impressive. You'll not get yourself overly excited by these people. And you'll be compassionate. You'll be compassionate to those whom the world deems insignificant and not to be that valuable, because you'll have the eyes of God on those whose society casts aside. This week, I was in a conversation with a group of people, and somebody else joined the conversation, eager to speak with one person who was in that group. And where they positioned themselves meant that they had turned their back to me, and I was now on the outside of the circle. And I was like, while I was plotting their death, I wasn't really, I was just thinking I'll get them back a little bit. I was thinking to myself, right, I was instantly annoyed because I was part of the conversation. This other person arrived in, big personality, locked down in conversation. I'm like, thanks, I get to be a spectator in all that's going on now. I was thinking to myself, oh, I was really annoyed about it. But it didn't take too long for me to think, how many thousand times have I done that in someone? Probably in here, because I've been so eager to have a conversation with someone that I've ignored their children and spoken to them about a meeting that we're having this week, or I've spoken to the wife and ignored the husband because I've like, let's get my business done and I'm going to have a conversation and you're insignificant because you're not going to be at that meeting actually. Or you're not helping me in some way, so I'm not speaking to you. I'm just going to, I've probably done it a million times. But this week I had the privilege of feeling what it was like. It wasn't very nice. And I knew that person did not do that intentionally. They were not trying to cut me out. They had no agenda whatsoever. It just happened that way. And I felt small. I felt excluded. And as I was working through this passage, I'm reminded of the fact that there's a future society that awaits us where God will never turn his back on us. God will never cut you from the conversation. God will never be more preoccupied with somebody else that he'll forget about you. God will be present in your life. He will not turn his back on you. We are going to be in his presence forever, and that's guaranteed to us today. He will not turn his back on you. He is not more preoccupied with the important people. He is not more preoccupied with those who serve in the life of this church. He's not more preoccupied with the people who've been around this church for longer. His eyes are on you. He sees you. He loves you. He knows you. And we are citizens of heaven now. So we have a responsibility to represent him to the people who come across our path. The people who God sets in front of us. We can give those people a taster of heaven. We can create homesickness in the lives of other people as they get to see the values of the kingdom of heaven in us. We should cultivate in the lives of other people a memory of Eden, a memory of their parents' home and a longing to get back there. And just really quickly, just one thought, you know, as we finish. Not only does this passage reveal to us a memory, but there's a measurement in here that the carpet fitters would be really excited about and interested in, because the city was laid out like a square as long as it was wide. He measured the city with its rod and found it to be 12,000 stadia in length and as wide and high as it is long. And the shape of the city seems to be a square, right? My maths is poor, but it seems to be a square, equal sides. The only location in the Old Testament that was a square or a cube shape was the Holy of Holies, was the place in the temple right in the middle where the priest went once a year to sacrifice for the people and to encounter God. Couldn't even go in, was kept on the outside of it. This Holy of Holies, this cube space in the center of the temple. Now the city is a cube, and that is significant. These cubic measurements are to awaken within us a memory of that Holy of Holies where God's presence dwells. In the new heavens and the new earth, the whole city will be the Holy of Holies. The whole city will be that inner sanctuary where God's presence is known. There is no escape. There are no corners. There are no dark alleys where you can be under threat. God is there. God is with you. This is the attraction of heaven, God's presence. This is the big deal about heaven. Everything else pales in significance. Nobody asks what the candy floss is like at the Niagara Falls. It's like, what are you even talking about? You're at the Niagara Falls. Who cares what the candy floss is like? Nobody says, oh, you were at the Jan's Causeway. How was your coffee? It's like, what? Coffee's irrelevant. We're at the Jan's Causeway. That's the attraction. And the attraction of heaven is the presence of Jesus. Those are the things that we sometimes get distracted about. We get distracted about other things. We think about, you know, playing harps or drinking harp or a perfected, you know, golf swing in heaven. It's like, no, the presence of Jesus, verse 3 says, he will dwell with them. That's what we get excited about. We cannot escape his protection or care. The gates of this city are to be left open because there's no threat anymore. God cares for his people. No violence to overpower us. Every corner of this space that we inhabit experiences God's rule and reign. Our prayers are answered. It is on earth as it is in heaven. 12,000 stadia in length and high and wide as it is long. One calculation puts us at like 1,400 miles. That's not the point. It's just to say it's really, really high. The gap between heaven and earth is closed. There is no distinction anymore, no separation. Nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. My prayer is that none of us will be missing when heaven invades earth, when this city comes down, that we'll all be living there, that we'll all occupy that space. But it's only available for those who are made pure by Jesus. We don't pay or buy our own purity. We need to trust in him. Nothing impure will enter the new heavens or the new earth. In and of yourself, you are impure. You're outside of this. You have no right to it. You have no entitlement to it. Only through a relationship with Jesus Christ will you experience a life without tears or pain or sorrow or sea. Otherwise, it's only chaos. Apart from Jesus, only chaos. My prayer is that none of us will be missing and that all would enjoy the life he offers. Jamesy is going to come and lead us in song as we receive our morning offering.